Exodus chapter 2, we're going to start in verse 11, and we're going to talk about Moses's, we're going to talk some about slavery, really. Now, last week, we talked about the need to commit to the river, and that God's plan is kind of the river of life. It's kind of dangerous, it's a little bit scary. We talked about how you need to put your most valuable possessions and the things that you cherish most into the basket and surrender it to God. We talked about absolute surrender. We're going to kind of continue that theme because that's a theme that walks all the way through Exodus. You see, everywhere you turn in Exodus, somebody has to give up everything in order to gain everything. So here we come to the story of Moses, and you've all heard the story, but we're going to read it again just for the sake of... In verse 11, one day when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and he looked upon their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. When he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. And he said to the man in the wrong, "Now, why do you strike your companion?" And the man answered, "Who made you prince and judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" And Moses was afraid and thought, "Surely the thing is known." When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters. And they had come and drew water and filled the troughs to water their flock, their father's flock. The shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses stood up and saved them and watered their flock. When they came home to their father, Reuel, he said, "How is it that you have come home so soon today?" And they said, "An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock." And he said to his daughters, "Where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may come and eat bread." I don't often invite people over to eat bread, you know, but it's a big deal to them. So he may come and eat bread. And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah. And she gave birth to a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, "I've been a sojourner in a foreign land." Okay, we're going to dive right in tonight and kind of look at this. Up close, if you'll look at verse 11, it says, "One day when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people." Now remember, Moses was raised by who? Right, which was? His mother. He was raised by his mother, a Hebrew woman, by the providence of God. Because remember, she puts him in the basket, sends him down the river, and Pharaoh's daughter finds him. She should have, could have, and probably would have killed him had it not been for the providence of God on her to take the child, protect the child, and say to one of her servants, who happened to be Moses' sister, "Hey, go get a Hebrew woman to nurse this child." And so she's like, "All right, I know exactly who to get. Hey, mom." And so she gets the mom, and the mom comes, nurses the Hebrew child until the boy is old, until he's grown to the point where he no longer needs, you know, so he's probably like 10, and he no longer needs as much attention. And he takes her to Pharaoh's She takes Moses back to Pharaoh's daughter and gives him back to her. Now Moses grows up in Pharaoh's household. He's raised with all the trappings that you could want. He's rich, he's wealthy, he's got strength, he's got power, but look at what he does. Verse 11, "One day when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people." And one of the things that is indicative of this phrase, "his people," being repeated, is that means that Moses decided something. He made a decision that he was not going to be numbered with the Egyptians. He made a choice that he was not going to be one of the Egyptians. He wasn't going to be a Pharaoh. And he decided that he would humble himself and be numbered with the slaves. There's something peculiar about what Moses does. You see, he comes out and he sees the Egyptian beating the Hebrew, one of his people, and he looks this way and that, and seeing no one, he strikes down the Egyptian and he hit him in the sand. Now, what Moses tries to do here, go to Hebrews chapter 11. I want to validate where Moses decides to be his people. We interpret Scripture by Scripture. So if you go to Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23, I believe. Yeah, verse 23. You'll see something that it says about Moses right there. Okay, it says, I'm just going to start. So it says, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents. Okay, that's what we covered last week. Because they saw that the child was beautiful and they were not afraid of the king's edict. Verse 24 gives us this week, by faith, when he was grown up, he refused to be called Pharaoh's, the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt. For he was looking to the reward. Now flip back over to Exodus. I read that to you so that you would understand that when Moses slaughters this Egyptian, when he decides that he's going to take this into his own hands, he is making a declaration of sorts. He's saying to all of Egypt, essentially, I do not want to be Pharaoh's daughter's son. Pharaoh's daughter's son. I don't want to be the son of Pharaoh. I want to be a Hebrew, which is what I am. And so he decides to make himself one of the lowly slaves. He decides to make himself one of the slaves in order to be the liberator. Right, Jesus. This is another piece of foreshadowing that God did in the Old Testament in order to show you who Jesus was. Remember Philippians chapter 2. Right? He came in the very nature of a servant, taking the very nature of a servant, did not consider equality with God something that was robbed, but rather taking the very nature of a servant, became humble and obedient to death, even death on a cross. Right? Jesus did the exact same thing. When he comes for you and decides to be identified with you instead of staying in the palace. You with me? With me? I mean, this is kind of cool that Moses decides he's going to disregard all of the palace stuff. I mean, this means, in our time, this means no iPod, no TV, no cell phone, no car, no... I mean, we go further even. No shoes, no nice room, no air conditioning. And these people were treated lowly. They weren't treated well. They weren't living in nice places. I mean, they were living like what we hear about in India, where you have maybe 8 people in a one-room house that's 12 by 12, which is the size of most of your bedrooms. And that's the house. 8 people. And this is how most of them lived. So Moses, raised by his mother, put into Pharaoh's house, decides that he's not going to be one of Pharaoh's children. And then Moses does something that is, in particular, of special interest to us. He goes out one day and he sees this Egyptian beating some Hebrews. Now, beating a Hebrew. And he goes to the Egyptian and he takes him and he kills him. Now, Moses knew the prophecies, right? He knew that there would be a child of a woman, a seed of woman, that would rise to crush the head of the snake. And that was something that would be ingrained in every youth's mind, in every child's mind when they were young. Listen, there's going to be a liberator who's going to rise up to free us and take us into a land flowing with milk and honey. And it'll be beautiful. There's going to be this liberator who's going to take us out of slavery. And so this boy raises up. Now he's the son of Pharaoh, right? He's got all of the trappings. Not only that, but we know from Scripture that he's a good-looking, very strong, very athletic young man. I mean, he's the man. And so he's probably excelling in most of his athletic feats. And so he comes outside and he sees this Egyptian beating the Hebrew. And what goes on in his mind? I'm to be the liberator of my people. I'm to set them free. And he decides, he sees something attacking his people, and he goes to it and he kills that one thing and buries it in the sand. But there's a problem. You see, one man killing off one other man did not set the Israelites free from slavery. You see, the one action that Moses does, going to take out this one person, is just that. It's one action, taking out one person, and it does no good. And so Moses, in essence here, he tries to set himself up as a king. He tries to set himself up as the liberator. And so he comes before the people of Israel, and he liberates one of them. Right? He stops the one. But the guy's still a slave. The guy's still in slavery. He's not free. All Moses did was take away the oppressive agent. So there's this one oppressive agent on the people, and Moses takes it away. In the same way, brothers and sisters in Christ, when you are dealing with sin, to remove one oppressive agent is not enough. That does not set you free. To remove one little thing that's in the way does not set you free. Living a good life as a non-believer still means you're slave to sin. It doesn't set you free if you remove all the sin. It doesn't set you free if you remove the one oppressive agent. If you're struggling with sin, if you're struggling with sin in dark places, it will not set you free from sin just to remove one little agent. You need to remove the whole thing. It needs to go. It needs to be gone. Slavery does not, you don't get freed just because you remove one agent. And that's what one of the things I love so much about that song is that my chains, the song that we saw Allie dance to, my chains are gone and I've been set free. It's not, my chains are still on my wrists and I'm working on being free. It's, they're gone. Do you realize that phrase there describes you as a Christian? That you've been absolutely and totally set free from sin? Do you get it? I mean, can I get a head nod, something? Do you understand that? Then why do you still live as if you're a slave to sin? Why do we still live with so many other things in our view than Christ? If that's true. My guess is it's because you're trying to remove one oppressive agent instead of trying to remove the entire sin. Instead of trying to remove everything. I just want to follow this track. I don't have this written down, but I want to ask, don't raise your hands because that'll be awkward, but how many of you spend way too much time on your computer looking at unholy things? How many of you fill your minds with garbage all the time? I don't have to elaborate what garbage is, you know. In the name of fun. How many of you have decided that you're not going to drink, you're not going to have sex before marriage, and you're probably not going to smoke? But it's okay for you to watch some of the things that you watch that are so detestable to God. You see, what you've done is removed some of the oppressive agents. You've killed off one Egyptian. And yet you're staying in Egypt. You're not living in the freedom that is Christ. Because the freedom of Christ sets you free from sin. It doesn't just make you want to go to church and be around Christians. It sets you free from sin. I used to wonder why my unsaved friends would want to do the things they wanted to do. I remember one of them, always telling me how he wanted to do great things and be a really good person, and he wanted to love people. But every time that he would go home, he'd put on one of these horror movies that he loved so much more than anything else, really. And he would watch them, and it started to pour out in the way that he lived, to where he was callous to things. To where when we saw the National Geographic pictures of like tsunamis and earthquakes, and you saw all the people dying, and you can't help but your eyes just start to well up with tears because you think, oh my gosh, that's awful. He'd laugh. Because what he was doing as an unchristian, as a non-Christian, was trying to remove the one oppressive agent that was obvious, and he was staying in slavery. You see, Christ's righteousness requires more, doesn't it? Christ's righteousness requires a complete and total separation from sin. See, if Christ has done His work in your heart, then you are on your way to absolute and complete total purity. And I just want to ask Christians, what do you put in yourself? And what are you doing that is so much more important than Christ? I don't want you to die in this suburban Christianity that we have in America. This thing that says because you don't have R-rated movies on your iPod means you're okay. I mean, this Christianity that says because you don't watch certain things or because you don't do certain things, it's okay if you do the others because you're better than the other people. No. I don't want you to die in that thought. I want you to understand that Christ requires everything of you. All that you are. Everything you have. Every piece of you. That your chains would be taken off and thrown away. You know what it means that you're free from sin? It means that you're free to live to righteousness. Paul asked that since we are free from sin, should we go on sinning all the more that grace might abound? And the answer he gives you is by no means. No way should we do that. And inherent in his answer in the following two chapters of Romans is that you have a desire now to do good. And the awesome thing of it is you can. As opposed to before when you were bound to sin. And you could do no other. Christians, I ask again, what are you filling yourself with that is so much more important than Christ? You see, Moses attempts to put on his own righteousness, and he kills an Egyptian man trying to save the Hebrews, but he only removes one oppressive agent. And so in killing this Hebrew, he's trying to put on his own righteousness and say, I am righteous. I am the liberator. And God has something else in store. And so Moses goes the next day and he sees in verse 13, he went out the next day and behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. And he said to the man in the wrong, why do you strike your companion? And the man in the wrong said, who made you a prince and judge over us? Okay, now just a real quick note. The same thing happens to Jesus every day that he's on the earth. I mean, every single time Jesus says something, the Jews get angry at him. It's kind of like clockwork. You can actually watch it happen. Where Jesus says, how does he put it? He says, I am the Messiah. In this, I've come to heal the poor. I've come to set free the captives. In your hearing today, you are free. I mean, in your hearing today, this has been fulfilled. And he quotes a messianic prophecy in Luke chapter 4. He quotes a messianic prophecy, and then he rolls up the scroll and puts it away. And all the people are like, hey, look at him. That's Joseph's son. Yeah, I know Joseph. Joseph's a good guy. And they start talking about Jesus, and they start cheering him on. And they're all excited, and they get all riled up, and they're like, yay, Jesus said something good. And then Jesus says, doubtless you will say to me, physician, heal yourself. And he says, but I tell you, there were many widows in the time of Elijah, but only one was saved. And there were many lepers in the time of Elisha, but only Naaman the Syrian was healed. And it infuriates them. So Jesus does one thing that's great, and then he says something else, and they get angry. Now Moses does one thing to try and set himself up as king, and then he comes out the next day, and they get angry. Again, God is foreshadowing what's going to happen with the Messiah, because this is a trend, right? I mean, they cross the Red Sea, and the people grumble against Moses. They get food from heaven, and the people grumble against Moses. He turns bitter waters into clean waters, and they get grumble against Moses. And then he takes them out and they beat Amalek and they grumble against Moses. I mean, it's just over and over and over. The people don't want to see who their Messiah is. And so Moses comes here and these two men are fighting and they get into a fight and Moses says, why do you do this? And they say, who made you king over us? And I just want to reiterate again that removing the oppressive agent, no matter how strong, good, powerful, no matter how hard you work at it, no matter how righteous you are, no matter how much you do, no matter how well you can remove all the oppressive agents from your life, the only thing that's ever going to set you completely free from sin is Jesus Christ and His righteousness. An absolute, total surrender to that. There's nothing else that's ever going to free you. So brother or sister, you're struggling with sin. Turn to Christ's righteousness. Lean totally and fully surrendered to Christ. Because that's the only way that you're going to ever remove slavery from yourself. It's not going to be by your works or your deeds. You must depend entirely on Christ. So I want to ask you again, what are you filling yourself with that's more important than Christ? What are you putting into your heart? I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you've all been putting His Word into your heart all day, every day. Maybe I'm wrong. But if you're anything like me, that's not true. And you find yourself putting stuff into your heart that's totally worthless. Now, we have a second half of the story here. Because Pharaoh hears about it in verse 15, and Moses runs away into the land of Midian, and he sits down by a well, which is just a cool thought, again, that there's a well. Remember, we talked about the God who sees, and she sits down by a well. Called living well, right? And Jesus meets the Samaritan woman on the road by the well, right? So he sits down by this well. Remember, whenever food or water is mentioned in the Bible, it's important. So he sits down by this well. And it says, now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. The shepherds came out and drove them away. But Moses stood up and saved them and watered their flock. Okay, now I want you to imagine what happens here with Moses. He's just lost everything he knows. And he runs away into the land of Midian. And if you can get this picture in your head, if this is Egypt and you got the little triangle thing over here, the delta thing over here, and the Nile's here, and you got this little delta thing, and here's the sea, and then there's the sea, Mediterranean Sea up here, and then you got Israel up here. I know that was a really bad map, but anybody, you with me? Okay, that's good enough. So he runs across over into this little delta part here, and he's in the land of Midian, where Jethro is the priest of Midian, and the Midianites were kind of Hebrew-like people, so they were like Hebrews. They were Hebrews that weren't in slavery in Egypt, basically. Although they were a little different. They weren't worshipers. I mean, they were worshipers of Yahweh, but they weren't worshipers in descendant from Abraham. Does that make sense? A little? Okay, so they're over in Midian, and they have a priest named Jethro, and he's the priest of Midian, and he ends up being this really cool guy, by the way. And he has 7 daughters, and they come every day to water the flocks of their father. Now, there are 7 of them. They're attractive, and we know this because, well, yeah, he marries one of them. And the shepherds basically flirt with them all the time, and that's kind of why they get driven away. So there's 7 daughters, and they're leaving their father's flock, which says to us that he didn't have any sons. He didn't have any children. He didn't have any sons. He just had daughters. And so they're carrying out these sheep, I don't know how you herd sheep. I mean, I guess you push them or something. But, they're walking with the sticks, and they're like, yeah, 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 or whatever, their whips, whatever you use, and they fill a trough full of water, and then these shepherds kind of come out of nowhere, and they're depicted as kind of like schoolyard bullies, You remember when you were little and you'd be like on the swing, and the bully would come up and push you off and be like, my swing! And you'd be like, and the bully would laugh because you didn't hit hard enough, or maybe that's just me. But you'd have you'd have these schoolyard bullies, and they'd come and they'd knock you off things and they'd take them from you. And these shepherds are kind of like that. They just kind of kick everybody off of the, they drive away the other flocks, and they're like, ha! And you'd figure that since there's 7 women there, somebody would take compassion on them and be like, hey, look, we'll wait our turn. Go ahead. But what they do instead is they drive away the flocks and they yell at the women. Blah, 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 blah. And if you've ever seen a Middle Easterner yell, it's really kind of like that. They're like, and I know that because I roomed with one of them in college. His name was Mark Anthony, but it was kind of funny. He had blonde hair, blue eyes, and was 6'2" and looked like a surfer. But he would get angry and he'd take off his belt and he'd shake it in his hand, which I never understood because he was shaking it by the buckle. I don't really understand that. It wasn't like he held it like a whip. It was like he held it by the buckle and the rest of it hung down. And he was like, ah, la, la, la. But anyway, so he would yell when he got angry and he's just yelling for no apparent reason. But so that's kind of what they're doing, and they're driving away these flocks, and no one is there to protect them. And so what ends up happening is Moses is walking along. He's sitting by the well. He sees these 7 good-looking women coming. And he's sitting by the well. He's like, hey, they're cute. I got water. They're cute. And then he sees the shepherds coming. He's like, ah, I bet those are their husbands. Daggummit. And then the shepherds come down, and he just sits there for a couple minutes, and he sees what starts to happen. And he sees that these shepherds pick on him. And so he stands up, and he stands up to the shepherds, and he goes up, and I mean, this is like knight in shining armor kind of stuff. Like, you can imagine, you can imagine there are 5 shepherds, and Moses is like, get away. And they're like, no! And so he fights with all of them, and ta-da! And pow! And so he gets away. And he wins whatever the fight was, and he helps them water their flocks. And in essence, because Moses is good-looking and athletic, he's able to beat these shepherds and waters the flocks of these 7 women. And then what I think is really funny is if you follow the story, in verse 18, it says, when they came home to their father, Reuel, he said, how is it that you come home so soon today? In other words, this happened all the time. Like, this was normal. Like, they got picked on every time that they went to water their flocks. So they bring the sheep to be watered, and they every time they'd lose, the shepherds would come and pick on them and run them off, and then they'd have to come back again and then run off and come back. And so it was like this entire game all day. And they get home early, and the dad's like, why are you home so early? You're supposed to still be being picked on by the shepherds. And he says, And they say, an Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flocks. And he said to his daughters, then where is he? In other words, he looks at him and is like, an Egyptian? Where is he? Bring him here. What's wrong with you? You let the man water your flocks and then you leave him in the desert. And so they have to go back and get him and they bring him. And Moses comes and decides that he's going to stay with this man and kind of sit under him. Now, this man's name is very important. If you go back up there, look at what his name is in verse 18. Their father, Reuel. Now, some people would tell you that this is his name, that this is his name, and there's another guy named Jethro later. But what we see in the next chapter, in chapter 3, is that Moses' father-in-law's name is Jethro. Well, if this is his father and his name is Jethro, then this name must be a title. And I looked it up in Hebrew, and Reu means shepherd. And El means God. So this is the shepherd of God. And Moses comes to stand and stay with the shepherd of God. You see, he had tried to put on righteousness himself. But what he needed was absolute and complete freedom from slavery. And he needed to be completely separated from slavery and bondage. He needed to be freed. So he runs into Midian, a freed man. And when he gets there, he finds a shepherd of God. And he decides he's going to stay with this man and learn from him. Just like Moses, you need the righteousness of Christ to set you free from sin. You don't just need to remove one oppressive agent, but you need the righteousness of Christ in you, through you, working out in you. And just like Moses, you need to be free from the bondage of slavery. And then there's a couple things that you can do at your stage in life, because I know that most of us don't know where we're going tomorrow. I mean, I know you're going to school. I get that. But you don't know what you're going to do in the future. You don't know what your job's going to be or who you're going to marry or what it's like. And you don't know these things. And so there's a couple things you can see here that would probably help you. Number one is in verse 21, it says Moses was content to dwell with Reuel, the shepherd of God. Listen, what I'm telling you to do is find somebody older than you who's a shepherd of God. And sit under them. And yes, this is a good start. Youth ministry is a good start. Coming to youth and seeing your dorky youth pastor get stuck in things like that, that's a good start. That's a good start, but it's not the end. There's more intimacy that you need. You see, because in order to save yourself from the death of Christian, American suburbanite Christianity, you need to be doing more than what you think you're supposed to. You need to be intimate with somebody older who can shepherd you. An older man, if you're a guy, an older woman, if you're a girl, you need to be intimate with someone older who can actually know you, who you can know and you can see their flaws and you can actually learn from. You need to sit under a shepherd and dwell with them. That's what's so cool about this passage. He doesn't just go stay with him for a night and have bread. You know, he actually dwells with him and lives with him. And he's with him. And then next, I want to remind you, just be patient. You know, somebody asked me a while ago you all know my opinion on these things, but I'm going to say it anyway. Somebody asked me a while ago, why do you not like dating? And I told them, I just looked at it, and it took me a while to figure it out. I just looked at them and I thought for a while, and my answer was, it's not that I don't like dating. It's not that. And I said, it's that I don't like the impatience that it breeds. And I thought a lot about it, and I talked to this guy, and this is a guy in college that I know from Baylor. He's not one of you, so don't. I had that conversation with John. You didn't have that conversation with John. So this guy, I was talking to him, and he said, well, what is it about the impatience that you don't like? And I said, they're so anxious to get into a relationship that they can't possibly be prepared for. And they're so anxious to do it that they've forgotten to take the time to do it and to go slow and to remember that God has some things in view and in plan for you. And I said, so it's not dating I dislike. It's the impatience of needing and wanting these relationships so quickly and so soon without being prepared for them. Be patient, students. And I call you students because I want to remind you of where you are. You're not about to go off to the workforce. You're not about to have to go pay your own rent. You're not about to have to go buy your own clothes and feed yourself. Be patient. Patient and learn. Wait. Because yes, God has set believers free from sin. And yes, we are free to do righteousness now. But He has a plan for you. And that plan includes some learning. And some development. And some time. So be patient as you move forward. And remember that God has some big stuff planned for you. I mean, the things God has for you are unimaginable. I thought, I want to tell you an example of impatience. I thought I was supposed to be a medical missionary. Everybody in the room knows. I thought I was going to be a doctor. Everybody knows how, you all know my testimony. And I thought I was supposed to be a doctor, and I get to college. And I have all these things planned out in advance, and I get to college, and in freshman year of college, suddenly everything gets flipped upside down. And I was so impatient, I rushed into a horrible relationship. Because I was so impatient. It was an abusive, nasty relationship. Not physically, emotional, and mental abuse. And this, I look back on it and I think to myself, I ruined that girl's first 2 years of college. And she ruined mine because we weren't patient. Or because we wanted to rush into something. Everything looked fine, but because we weren't waiting and being patient on the Lord to develop us, we rushed in. And I want to tell you, God had an amazing plan for me. So much so that I'm married to the most beautiful, wonderful, amazing woman on the planet. I mean, she can sing, she can play piano, she can dance, she's a deeper thinker than I am. She reads more books than I do. She knows more of God. And if I had not had any time to stop at any point and be patient, all that would have happened was I would have been in an abusive relationship for the rest of my life. Be patient where you are. If you're in a dating relationship, be patient. It's not a marriage. Don't make it one. Don't let it become one. Be patient. If you're not in a dating relationship, maybe you ought to take the time to think about not getting into one. Just because though they may be fun, sometimes. There's a bigger plan for you, and you don't want to miss it. So in conclusion, only absolute and total freedom will free you from sin. Removing an oppressive agent's not going to work. If you're struggling with sin, take the whole thing out. If that means it's on your computer, you get rid of your computer. And I know that that means a lot. I know that that means you're going to confess a bunch to people. Because they're going to go, why don't you have any MySpace anymore? And you're going to go, well, you got an hour? I mean, it's going to take work. But if you want freedom from that sin, you need to want freedom from that sin. Get rid of your computer if that's the object. Put a filter on there and tell your mom and dad to put the filter on and to put a key on it that you can't figure out. If it's your slothfulness and laziness, work. Get up off your duff and do some stuff. Call somebody to keep you accountable. Find somebody who will do stuff with you. If it's the trash that you watch, throw it away. Tell your parents to limit your TV time. Boy, how much would that wig you out, Lori, if your kids came to you and said, hey, Mom, I feel like I've been watching too much TV. Could you just make sure that I only watch 5 minutes a day? Well, there you go. See, but how that would weird you out, wouldn't it? Yeah. I mean, go to your parents. If it's your TV and it's your television and it's your movies that you're watching, throw the movies away. Go to your parents and tell them, listen, I really feel like this is detracting from who I'm supposed to be. And if they laugh at you, be like, fine, I'm going to do it myself. And find some accountability. Find an older person to be intimate with. Find an older woman who can hold you girls accountable for becoming the woman you're supposed to be. Find an older man who can hold you guys accountable to becoming the man you're supposed to be. Listen, I have 3 intimate accountability partners that I call weekly. And we talk about some major issues. If I didn't have that, I wouldn't be who I am. If I didn't have that, I'd still be a show-off, good-for-nothing, arrogant college jerk. But because I've got 3 guys who will call me on the phone and say, hey, how are things with your wife? And if I say, oh, they're fine, and don't elaborate, they're going to be like, okay, why are you lying? So they're going to say, how are things in your mind and with your work schedule? Have you been taking a Sabbath? And one of them, I love this, he always tells me this, that he calls and like, how's the Sabbath thing going for you? Have you been resting? Have you been taking Sabbath? I'm like, oh yeah. I had Saturday off. Yeah, I took Saturday off. He's like, that's not what I asked you. And his response is always the same. That's not what I asked you. I asked you, have you been taking a Sabbath to worship God? Every time it's the same thing because I'm so dense, I never answer with the right answer. Have you been taking time to worship God? Have you been reading your word? Have you been sitting under a shepherd? Have you had the intimacy of a shepherd of God in your life? And finally, be patient. Students, be patient. Exodus is going to pick up real soon. So are things in your life. Stuff's going to happen. Really quickly. It's going to go real fast. For most of you, it's about a year away. For some of you, 2, 3. For you younger ones, you got more time. Be patient. Don't be in a hurry to get things done. God's got it under control. So if the band will come up, I'd just like to take a couple minutes. We put up this cross and you saw an interpretive dance. I know that Baptist churches aren't supposed to have dances, but that's what that was. It was a dance. And
and it was an interpretive dance. My chains have gone. I want to give you some time before we go anywhere to recall that Christ has set you absolutely, totally, and completely free. He didn't set you partly free. He didn't set you free from everything except that one thing you do in your closet when you're by yourself. He didn't set you free from everything except that one thing that you do on the computer that nobody else knows about. He didn't set you free except for that one thing that you've been walking around letting people think that you're somebody different. He didn't set you free from everything except those. He set you free from those. You don't have to do them. So if at any time during our worship tonight you need to kneel down here to surrender some of those things as an act of worship, you feel free to. But I want to challenge you tonight to engage the God who made you, who has set you free from slavery, and has made you free to follow Him in righteousness. Let's pray. Father, we know that You have great plans on our lives. That You have works and You have designs for us to do that are far beyond what we could ever imagine or want or conceive of. Lord, I am sorry that we have not come prepared as we should. But that we have stood at Your altar and have forsaken Your word. So Lord, I pray You would forgive us and meet us in worship tonight.